You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stuart Goldsmith here. Thank you so much, those of you who've got in touch about last week's episode with Russell Cain. It was a banger, wasn't it? And remember, you can get the extra content from that one at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, as well as all the extra content from every episode that has it. This one doesn't. It's an hour and a half banger of an episode with the fabulous Bethany Black. And Bethany had so much to say and articulated it so well that I just couldn't make decisions as to what to put on the insiders feed. So here it is in all its glory for everyone. And on the subject of all its glory, we're going to be talking about the price of being a social justice warrior. We're going to talk about Bethany's diagnoses with ADHD, autism and agoraphobia concurrently as they came. We're going to talk about her disappointment that her fans, this is lovely, I don't want to spoiler it, but honestly, there's a lovely conversation about the recognition that her fans are not necessarily the people she wanted to impress at school, they're people like her. That is such an insight. I really enjoyed that. We'll talk about the hard gigging years, and we'll talk about the fact that at the moment, because Bethany and her partner, I believe, are immunocompromised, she has only left the house 3 times in the last year. We'll get into that, as well as some difficult stuff which requires a content warning. We're going to talk about some stuff that Bethany's talked a lot about on stage, but we will be mentioning suicide attempts. So there's a little content warning for you if you are concerned about stuff like that. And we'll talk about the cost of sharing enough of yourself that you make a lasting connection with your audience, exactly what it costs you to share that much. And there's a little bit of stuff at the end about Twitch. It's an absolute crack of an episode and it's all here for you, but why not join the Insiders Club anyway in celebration of the fact that this time you didn't have to? Here's Bethany Black. I've got so many questions. You are a very broad kind of a performer. There's the acting, there's the comedy, and then inescapably we are coming up for a year on the pandemic. And I think you've started twitching. So let's talk about that first. You've been on Twitch since when?
14th of November is the first date. Like, I'd set up because I was doing Mark Watson had been doing a couple of 24-hour shows on there, and he got me on the last one, which I think was sort of like end of October, beginning of November. It was around, I think it was Halloween weekend. Because, and said, like, what would you like to do for it? And I was like, oh, well, I've got a talent that, it's partly because I'm autistic, that if you tell me something, I can just absorb huge amounts of information and then recount it, on any topic, really, over a short amount of time. If you give me a short amount of time to do some reading, I can talk to it with an expert level of accuracy within sort of 24 hours, if that's what you want.
And I will resist the urge now to try and test you on this, A, because I don't have access to any knowledge in my brain or in any sources nearby.
So he went, oh, that'd be brilliant. So they got me on the 24-hour show to do. He sent me away, gave me, I think he gave me something like 12 hours to learn everything that I could about frogs. Toads. Which was great because that meant I didn't have to do anything about frogs. I could go and go, oh yeah, well, all toads are frogs, but not all frogs are toads. So you've essentially gone and cut down about 60% of the information I would have needed to have learned. And they gave me this at like 2 o'clock in the morning and I had to go back on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was like, right, well, I'm going to need 8 hours to sleep. So I'm going to go and do that.
4 hours of cramming about toads.
And went on and gave a 15-minute talk about toads.
Can you still access all? I'm not going to test you. Can do you? Are you able to still access all of that information?
I can access
short-term memory.
I can access most of that information. Some of it, some of the finer details that I've almost certainly forgotten, but okay. Most of it has stuck in there.
When did you become aware in your life that that was a thing you can do, and b that was unusual?
When I was little, from being very little, I was quite a solitary kid, and I used to sit and watch. I used to get up on a Sunday morning and watch things like the Open University and stuff like that on BBC Two, and just sit there for hours and then go up to my mum and go, "Did you know that a Google is the longest number that they have in the universe, which is a one followed by 6,000 zeros?" And just coming up with just all of the information that was out there and going, "All right, okay, I'm going to store this." Even stuff I didn't understand, I could then much later recite that. My parents, the thing that made me realize that it was a bit odd was that when I was I must have been about 3 or 4 years old, my parents had someone come around to the house to do some work, a builder, and I just followed him around talking to him, because that was what I did as a child, just follow around adults talking at them for hours on end. And went out as he was sort of walking backwards and forwards to his van, I went, "Oh, that used to be our carpet that we used to have in the living room." And my mum went, no, that's a carpet like the one that we used to have." And the builder started looking all sheepish and went, "Actually, no, that isn't. That is actually, no, she's right. I was driving past, and when you threw it out, and this is the house that I actually got it from." I went, "Oh, that would do good in the back of my van. It is the actual one." And my mum was just like, "Well, how did you know that?" And I went, "Because there's a patch missing there and there's a patch missing there." And I couldn't have been more than 6 months old when it had gone.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So my brain just has always just any information that gets put into it just sticks and doesn't go anywhere. And as I've got older, it's got worse. But for a lot of the time when I was a small child, I had total recall of pretty much everything. So I never revised.
I was going to ask when you said it's got worse.
Yeah.
I was going to ask whether you meant, it's worse. I can remember everything without fail, and it's murder. You mean actually it's degraded slightly. So the total.
Yeah, yeah, it's degraded. And I almost entirely put that down to the amount of drugs that I did as a teenager.
Okay.
Yeah. And in my 20s. But up until that point, I never revised for anything. I never revised for anything throughout school or through right the way through till the end of doing my degree. It's really only been in acting now that I have to go over and over and over things in order to force words to stick in my head.
Oh, that's unusual. So you don't have recall for scripts?
Not anymore. Used to when I was little, I was able to memorize. I memorized the entirety of the Blackadder, the second script, when I was about 6 or 7 years old. Every single word for word. And we didn't have a video recorder in our house until the mid 90s. So this was I'd seen them maybe
from a
once
single viewing.
From a single viewing, yeah.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And listen, we'll loop back to Twitch because I want to pursue this. I know that in 2018, and this is an extraordinary sentence, you were diagnosed with autism, ADHD, OCD and agoraphobia.
Yeah.
Is that in one session or
no.
Just in 1 year? Because let's talk about this. And I don't want to over focus on these things. Obviously, they are not everything that defines you. But no. I know that you talk about them online, and I know you talk about them in your work. Let's just get into the extent to which. OK, the follow up question is the extent to which those things, that diagnosis, either defined you or helped you define yourself, or what you kind of learned as a result of that diagnosis. And the initial question is, in one session? that's the
yeah,
first question.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was not. I'd been seeing a therapist because I was really struggling. We were just the agoraphobia diagnosis was one that that blindsided me a little bit, because we were in the session and she went, "So what do you think's been causing this agoraphobia?" And I was like, "What are you talking about? I'm not agoraphobic." Agoraphobia, that's the guy out of Game On who's just stays at home and lives in a fantasy world, or Sigourney Weaver in Copycat, where she just communicates with people via the internet. Oh fuck yeah, no, I am. Yeah, I am. And it was over the course of about 6 weeks when we were talking about that she, that I at one point just went, "Oh, because I'm autistic," because I'd known that I was autistic for a long time before I got a diagnosis.
Okay.
And it's one of those things that when people who are autistic go to their doctor and they go, I think I'm autistic, doctors, I think, assume, oh, you've done a BuzzFeed quiz of what neurodivergence am I? And it's come up with with autistic. Ah, yeah, six questions, right? I don't believe you.
The idea, just to stay on that for a second, the idea of a BuzzFeed quiz about one's own neurodivergence is one of the most internet things I've ever heard. That's beautifully put. Yes, okay.
Whereas, you know, most people who go to a doctor and go, I think I'm autistic, they're saying, I think I'm autistic because they haven't got a diagnosis yet and therefore don't want to be exact, because that is not a thing that autistic people are great at. Being exact when they're not entirely sure. And what it usually means is that they've spent the last 2 to 3 years researching absolutely everything that is available, or, well, studying everything that is available, because they're not researching anything. They've not got funding. They're not getting it peer reviewed. Just like studying everything that they can about autism and going, absolutely match this. Right. Okay. So I need, because I've my two nephews, my sister's got identical twins who are both, autistic. And it was from that and through spending time with my sister and through her talking about that and going through the developmental stages and going, these were all things that happened with you when you were growing up. And so I mentioned it offhandedly to my therapist and she just went, would you like an autism diagnosis? And I went, yeah, cool, let's do that. So she put me, I got on the waiting list for that and it was 18 months until they got me in and I did the first half of it. And whilst I was there... It was beautiful because University of York was doing a study into people who were diagnosed late in life that they're autistic. And so they said, oh, if you're willing to fill in this questionnaire, you can get a £20 Amazon voucher.
A prize for your BuzzFeed quiz.
But this was like in the first stage and they went, if you are autistic, then we'll ask you a follow-up question. Send up a follow-up questionnaire and we'll send you another voucher. I was like, oh, great, cool. So I did the first half of this assessment and essentially went home, panicked over the weekend because I'd given them the wrong number of a Marvel Comics thing when they were asking about my special interest, and I said it was the Incredible Hulk 180 Incredible Hulk 181 when it's the Incredible Hulk 180. Had got a reference to it wrong and phoned them on the Monday going, I'm really sorry, I gave the wrong number, and like as if that would be the thing that they would go, no, you're not autistic.
They replied, do you want the voucher now?
This was the thing, because the voucher arrived 3 days before I actually got the diagnosis, and I was like, oh, brilliant, so at least I know. This is the best way of finding out that you're autistic. This is the best way of finding out any information ever, any medical diagnosis, just send you a voucher along with it.
And what did the diagnosis mean to you? If it was something you were convinced of beforehand, if you knew beforehand, did the diagnosis have any meaning for you? Did it have any weight?
Yeah, it did. It did, because it suddenly meant that it allowed me to go, oh, these things that I struggle with. All right, okay. I can actually accept that they are things that I struggle with and that I'm not just a bad person who's rubbish at things. Who, you know, on the one hand, it was great because it was like, it doesn't matter how hard I try. I'm never going to be able to fully assess what other people's actions and intentions are, what other people's intentions are from the little micro body language that we give off. On the other hand, it was like, oh God, no matter how hard I try, I'm never going to be able to learn what other people's intentions are from the micro body language that they give off. It managed to do both of those things. It allowed me to go, right, okay. It allowed me to give myself, allowed me to go easy on myself over a lot of things. And also allowed me to go, right, okay, in which case I can lean into certain things, which really helps with comedy. Just going, this is who I am and these are the things that there's no point in me trying to fight against this in terms of what I'm trying to create on stage. I might as well go with it.
It's just on that, I think that's that experience, that insight is probably also found by lots of other comedians in lots of other ways, to do with neurodiversity. The sense that actually I've learnt what I am. And I can lean into it now. That's probably a big part of... Had you had any experience in your comedy practice like that in a parallel way that wasn't to do with neurodiversity? Had you
had you been
through a moment of going, I've got to stop fighting and just be this?
Yeah, I had. I did that with talking about being gay on stage, and to a lesser extent with being trans, which I still struggle with talking about on stage, which I will, which I'm doing more of now, which has been really helped by doing stuff online. That's really, really helped with that. And it was the same thing when I realised that I had ADHD, which again, and I tell it as a joke, but it is absolutely true that my sister had got an ADHD diagnosis and said, I think you would really benefit from this. And I was like, whatever. She sent me the list of the symptoms and it was like 3 pages long, the diagnostic criteria. And I just looked at it and went, I'm not reading that. That is too long for me to go and sit and read through just on the off chance. And it was about 18 months later when I did read through it. And just like by the time I'd got to the end of it, I was in tears because it was suddenly all of those things that I thought actually made me a bad person that didn't care about other people were all written down there. Every single one of them, all of the things that I'd beaten myself up over for my entire life. And I was like, And then once I knew that, then I could really lean into that as well on stage. I think with every new thing that I've learned about myself, it's been, because also, again, recovering addict, which again is often tied in with ADHD because a lot of it comes down to impulse control and then building up OCD type reactions to things, that you get intrusive thoughts and you get an obsession that then becomes a compulsion that you have to do something. And if you've got ADHD, then your the limbic system, which is the reptile part of the brain at the bottom of it, doesn't properly interact with your prefrontal cortex. So you tend to do things impulsively because you can't associate the idea of dopamine with, which is the chemical which gives you happiness, which and you can't really sort of associate it with deferred gratification. Delayed gratification. So as a result of that, you want whatever it is now, quick, more and more and more of it. And you can't, your brain actually just can't go and separate those two things out. So addiction then becomes a thing which happens quite often with people with ADHD.
And given, obviously, there's a lot of things going on here, and I'll try and kind of like kind of buttonhole each one as we go. Just on that, with regard to addiction, which, what were you addicted to and how did you get off it, seeing as you are, as you said, with ADHD, you are particularly susceptible to that addiction? Did you have to take that into account when trying to break the addiction?
I didn't realize I had ADHD until a long time after I was clean and sober.
And
in terms of addiction, it was just taking anything that came across my path. So alcohol was my primary one, just because that's the one that goes and shuts up the little voice in your head that tells you that everything's wrong for about an hour, and then it comes back and screams at you. So you have to drink more to try and drown it out. And when I stopped drinking, I took a lot of MDMA and speed and cocaine and stuff like that, which again, these are ones which really, because the medication that they give you for ADHD is essentially, it's amphetamine, because it goes and allows those two parts of your brain to connect and to be able to do those things, which seems odd when it's like, if you're ADHD, then surely you're really speedy anyway. So why would you need to go and put speed on top of that? But all it does is it goes and allows them to connect. It was an interesting thing when I was sat in getting the ADHD diagnosis and they asked whether I'd taken any other drugs. And I went, oh yeah, I used to do cocaine quite a lot. And they said, so what did cocaine do for you? And I went, it's really strange. It just sort of like gave me the confidence to shut up. And they went, sat there and started taking notes. And I was like, huh. And at the end, they just said, yeah, that's a really good indicator that the medication that we can give you for this will really help, because that's essentially what you were chasing. So a lot of it, it turns out, was in some ways self-medicating, but overdoing the self-medication.
Yes, okay, overdosing on the cure kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of. Which
okay.
is a lot of what addiction is. A lot of what addiction is just trying to cope with the trauma of feeling wrong and then just doing whatever you can to try and erase that feeling.
And as someone who has felt wrong in the past and... You've sort of, your comedy, or certainly comedy is an opportunity for lots of people to kind of either to correct a wrong or to reappropriate a wrong or a wrong feeling. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to take the aspects of myself which I feel bad about, whether that's shame or guilt or anger or whatever those things, and actually, A, express them, and B, by expressing them, kind of be in charge of them, take the reins.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely what I've tried to do. It was so interesting again last year, because I had a really long intensive psychotherapy not even session, it was 6 months of psychotherapy I did, and I say last year, 2019, worked really really hard on that, because you know, last year didn't exist. I'm going to be 41 until I emerge from lockdown. I have decided upon that. In that, I realised I did a lot of thinking about what I do and how I react to things, and realised how much of doing stand-up was a coping mechanism for me. I think it's an interesting thing that I realised a couple of weeks ago, that through talking about this on my Twitch stream and with another comedian, Susan Kalman, in fact, I was chatting with her and about it, and saying that when I started doing stand-up, it was almost a thing of, I'll show those kids at school who were horrible to me. I'll show them all. Whoa. And like, when you set off, I think, or at least in my experience, I wanted to be famous when I was a child because I wanted people to like me. And then I became a comedian, and I still wanted people to like me. But I also wanted to impress those people who are horrible to me at school, to make them see where they've gone wrong. I'll show them.
Yeah.
And as I became popular as a comedian and as an actor, and I started to get fans, which I hate that idea. When I started to get people who like the work that I do,
they're called fans.
Yeah, yeah,
they're called fans.
Yeah, they're called fans. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I always feel like that goes and puts me like, oh yeah, my fans. It's that.
The fact that you find it difficult to talk about, in my mind, is simply a marker of class.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I was really disappointed when I started to get fans that they weren't the kids that I wanted to impress at school. They were the kids that I was at school.
Oh, that is an incredible insight. Yes, okay. If I laugh too hard at that, I betray something of my own experience.
And at first, I hated that. It was because you know how like the things that we often hate about us, about other people, are the things that we see of ourselves in them. And I saw that.
Oh, yes.
I saw that in my fans and was like, well, this is not what I wanted at all. It really was that almost Greek tragedy type of, monkey's paw closing sort of moment. Oh, God, my fans are all fucking nerds.
I thought I would be cool. I'm speaking for you here, but you thought you would be cool and impress the cool kids that you could never impress. And then, or maybe the cool kids, the mean kids, the tough kids,
the confident kids, which
were the ones you most wanted to impress out of all of those, like cool, confident, which, what aspect, popular?
I think it was,
what aspect was it you were chasing?
I think it was the popular, confident kids, not the cool kids, because I had quite a few of the cool kids as my friends. I was a kind of an outsider kid at school, because even though I had all of this stuff going on where I could just ace any exam without really having to try, I was like that weird outsider kid that you get in 1980s movies who was all dressed in black but could just turn up and do whatever it was. I was that kid that you'd see in those movies, that archetype. Okay. Who would turn up and pass every exam but would be be out there smoking and drinking behind the bike sheds. But there was always that sort of like, I don't even know how you describe, I think the term that they use on the internet is basic people. Like, it was just like people who were going to be happy with how their lives turned out. The people who were just neither going to be super cool nor super dorky, but seemed to be confident in themselves and confident with where their lives were going, and were going to go off and have 9-to-5 jobs and families and houses and all of those things that are just sort of like the Middle Englanders. I think that was who I was trying to impress at school, thinking about it. I've never really thought about it, but just looking at it and going, yeah, those people who didn't seem to be troubled by existential thoughts.
people arguably who represented the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. People who I thought of as normal and to whom I felt very much sort of opposed to, very much, you know, that my reflection was against it. And it was that thing of realizing, I think partly because I realized, especially when I went to secondary school, that in spite of being the smartest kid in school, and in spite of being able to do any of these things, that I wasn't popular with, in the way that a kid who I went to school with who became both the head boy and sports captain was. Like, the only person who'd ever done that, who, like, was ridiculously good looking, who everybody, just like all of the teachers, just sort of treated as a peer, and who, like, left school, and I think now he works for Deloitte in London. Like, yeah. One of the only people from my little tiny town who went off to go to London and ended up working for an international Big Five accountancy firm. And I think that was what I was trying to impress. Yeah, yeah, winner.
A normal winner.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, yeah, it was him. I think it was entirely down to trying to impress Tim the Lormit. That was his name.
And it runs to LinkedIn.
He was nice, though. He was a nice guy. And, like, we got on well enough at school. It wasn't like I really desperately... But it was just, like, everything that he represented. I was like, I think that's kind of the life that I want. I think that's the life that I want. Because you could see straight away that he was going to be someone who was going to win at absolutely everything. And that was kind of what I wanted.
And so the popularity that you sought was that people... was an element of it that people would regard you as a popular winner, not simply that you'd win the appreciation of this particular person whose name I think I have to beep out.
But
it, not just that you'd impress him, but that also people would look at you as if you were a kind of bastion of normal winnerness.
Absolutely. That was it. That was what I wanted. I wanted to be sort of like that pinnacle of that everyone liked, who was nice, who didn't have any of my faults, who didn't have any of the awful things.
So talk to me then about the difference between your audience regarding you as a, I mean, maybe your audience regard you as a bastion of their flavour of normality. And is that good enough for you?
Yeah, they do. And now it is, yeah. When I started, it wasn't. I'm so glad
because no would be a terrible answer at this point.
No, I hate my fans. They're arseholes. I hate all of them. No. I love them. No, I really, really do. And I really appreciate it. And the thing that I've discovered with doing the Twitch streams is that I now have a community. Cult community, call it what you will. But I have a community. I have a Discord server where I occasionally pop into to tell them about whatever's going on in the show, and I see them all talking to each other and being really supportive and being really lovely to each other, and they are exactly the sort of community that I always wanted, and they're the exact sort of people I always want to think that I am trying to be. And they are, because those are the people that I've attracted, because you attract back what you put out into the world. And I think that's the thing that I learned from watching comedians that I really, really loved, whose audiences I absolutely despised. Mm-hmm. There are certain comedians who I know who I absolutely adore what they do, whether it's like dirty or whether it's like true stories that go and paint them in not a great light, or if they do shocking material or any of those sorts of things that they do. And I love them. And I can't go and watch them live because their audience, I find, has such a threatening mood hanging over them that it's just like, whilst I would probably like to be able to do that sort of material in the way that they do it, I really wouldn't like that to be my audience because I really don't feel a connection with it.
Do you think that you are enjoying the work of those comics differently to their audience? Or what is it that you can... Because one might imagine if the work is attracting a particular kind of audience, my assumption, I suppose, would be that the work would not attract you. Is it that you as a comic kind of appreciate the craft of the work in it, or a sort of you can appreciate it amorally and say, I like what you did there, but you feel the audience are appreciating it in a way whereby they're missing a subtlety or something like that? Or is it something else?
I think you're right there. And that sounds awful to do that, but I think it's from being a comedian. And when I started out, I was one of those comics who because I've painted myself into a corner as I've got older with my stand-up. Which is a really interesting thing that I've learned, especially since everything has sort of stopped in the last year, and knowing that when I am allowed to get back out on stage, that what I'm going to be doing is going to be different, because I've now written a different style, and I'm moving more towards that, and I'm moving more towards the stuff that I do in my hour long shows, which is very different from what I would do as part of a 20 minute set. And when I started out, I was one of those comedians who absolutely confused being offensive with being funny, and didn't realise that there also needed to be the joke. Well, knew that there needed to be the joke in there, but assumed that the shocking bit was the funny bit, and it isn't. And so those sorts of comedians, when I started out, were the comedians that I went, I absolutely love these comics. I love to go and watch these comics. I love to go and... I liked that sort of stuff. Because I grew up... massive comedy nerd, but like throughout the 90s on Channel 4 late at night, they would show stand-up specials like Bill Hicks and Dennis Leary and all of those things, and they'd have Just for Laughs. They would show that on Channel 4 every year, and then during the Edinburgh Fringe they'd go and show, like, they'd have like shows throughout the last week of that, showing all of the people who were up and coming. I remember seeing Jason John Whitehead on one of those for the first time in like 1999, doing some stuff at the Edinburgh Fringe back when he had the big dreadlocks and everything.
I'd forgotten about the dreadlocks.
Seeing him, and that was the same year that Ross Noble sort of broke through at the Edinburgh Fringe, and watching these comics and going, these are the seeing the stuff that was sort of coming through throughout that time and going, this is something that I would really like to do but didn't think I'd be able to. And it was particularly sort of the Bill Hicks, Dennis Leary, and then from that through to people like Doug Stanhope, and then in the UK, like Jim Jefferies and Frankie Boyle, when they were on the UK circuit, and watching those guys and going, this is the sort of stuff that I really like and stuff that I'd like to be able to do. And to an extent, I think my stand-up did kind of follow that. But then to go, ah, actually, as I grew older and learnt empathy a lot better... and learnt and going, actually, no, I don't want to have to keep justifying saying things that aren't nice, and I kind of want to move away from that. And so my stuff just ended up becoming dirtier and dirtier, and became more sexual content, which isn't what, like, because if I went to go and see me do stand, this is, because this is the strange thing, even though I love my fans, and even though my fans have followed me because of what I do and they like me because of what I do, I don't think that they particularly, the ones who are sort of like, that I know that I'll be able to, who I know will stick with me until I decide that I want to stop doing this. I'm not entirely sure that they're a big fan of the filth side of things. They'd like it occasionally in little sporadic bits, but not as much as I tend to do when I'm doing a club set. Because I know that if I went to watch me do stand-up, if I was sat in an audience watching me do stand-up, I would go... No, that's not to my taste. I've kind of painted myself into a corner with that, in that I know that that's what gets into, in that I know that that's something that I've got really, really good at, because I know how to figure out exactly what the worst possible thing is, but say it in a way that, with a smile, and in a way that goes and drags people along. So it's just me being cheeky and me taking them out of their comfort zone and then bringing them back into their comfort zone with something else. So I can talk about certain things, and then I can go bang, and then I can go and add an extra little topper and a little topper, and each of the little toppers that I go and do. So, like, I've got a fisting joke that has, like, that started off as a single joke about that, and it's now a 5-minute bit, and it has something like 8 or 9 toppers, and each one of them just takes you a little bit further out before then bringing you back in.
So this is Beth, really enjoying this. Apologies for the crummy quality of my audio on this episode. As you may hear me say on the episode, I had to evacuate the house and was recording most of it in a van. And then if at the end of the episode the audio gets slightly better, that's because I had retired to my studio indoors. And if the audio gets worse, that's because Nathan's done an incredible job of cleaning up the van audio. What fun it is to have a little camper van that you can pull the curtains around such that when you're recording in the back of it, you don't get funny looks from people passing by. There is a moment coming up towards the whereabouts. I'll tell you exactly where it is. It's in the last, it's about 10 minutes before the end of this episode, where Bethany, my connection failed just as Beth was talking about coming home to a green room, and without giving anything away, but we'll talk about green rooms, and there's a really interesting and very poignant insight that she offers us from that situation. and I don't respond to it because by that time my connection had failed just at an incredibly beautiful, heartfelt moment. So we'll just pop a, I'll just get Nathan to pop a little sting in there. Get in touch with me in all the usual places, info@comedianscomedian.com. You can also, oh God, you can use the contact form on my website. But if you've done that in the last 2 years, 1,000 apologies because it's been going directly to a spam filter, which deletes things every month. So I was able to get back to 2 people from that, and everyone else, please don't think me rude. If you have used the contact form on the website, comedianscomedian.com, I'm sorry, it's been lost. If you're thinking that I'm this absolute prick and you're only listening under sufferance because I never replied to your email, it may be because it's in there, because I make a point of replying to absolutely everything. So with that in mind, at ComComPod, info@comedianscomedian.com. And here are the places you can get in touch with Bethany. You can follow her on Twitter at Bethany Black, BefferniBlack, Black. Bethany Black. And you can also go to the same address on Twitch, twitch.tv/BefferniBlack with 2 F's. So, and do follow her on Twitter as well. She's very, very funny and very kind of meaningful and interesting and does Twitter properly in a way that I can only dream of. Like, it's considered and thought out and funny and meaningful and stuff. You know, a good Twitter feed. So get cracking on that. Here's more from Bethany now. No insiders content this time. It is all here for you for free. But if you are enjoying the show and would like to become an insider, there has never been a better time. ComediansComedian.com/insiders. Let's get back to Bethany Black.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I feel the balls that we have in the air at the moment, in my mind, are you love certain comics, but you would feel kind of hostility from their audience. So their appreciation of the material is maybe different to yours. And yet also there's this kind of parallel track of you thinking that if you were sat in the audience of your own show, you'd think it was a bit much. And I think there's got to be some relationship between those two concepts.
Yeah, I think it's that I've grown up. I think it's that as I've grown up, I've changed and my tastes have changed. But, and this is the thing that I think is the absolute key to this, is that because I spent so long learning how to become a stand-up comedian, because when I started off, there's that thing of, like, when you go out in front of an audience, they know what they, when your name's announced, right, they create an image of you in their head. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've already got an image of what a comedian's going to look like anyway. And they create an image in your head based on your name. And then you walk out and they see you. And however far you deviate from what the image is in their head is how much harder you kind of have to work to get them, to win them over and to keep them on site. And the more things that you add which go and take you away from that, the more difficult it is. And not just with audiences, but also with promoters, because a lot of promoters tend to book based on people who are like them, people who are to their taste rather than my audience will like. They say, my audience will like this, but a lot of the time it's, I like these comedians, so I want comedians who look and sound and talk about the same things that I do.
You absolutely never hear a promoter say, well, I can't stand this act, but my audience love him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Every single time. Yeah, and so for a long time, it was difficult for me to get enough stage time, partly because when I started off, the stuff that I felt that I wanted to talk about was more difficult for me to figure out how to be able to make it palatable to an audience. I've said, you know, difficult for me to get away with, but which is kind of true, but it is. It's some of the stuff that I talk about has been difficult to make palatable for an audience, which has meant that it's a little bit more risky, which has meant that I've died a little bit, meant that I died more times than a lot of other comics when I was just starting out. But it also, because I stuck in the mind of both the audience and the promoters, it meant that they were less likely to rebook me. So it took me a longer time to get to the point where I had enough work as a comedian to be able to like relax into being on stage at the bigger weekend gigs and be able to go, right, okay, I'm just going to mess around with this. Like, I started doing Jonglers at the point at which they'd stopped paying people, mostly. And I was one of the last people who were still regularly getting paid, because I'd done a bunch of tryouts for them when I was brand new. And it had gone badly enough that they didn't book me back for another 10 years. And so by the time they booked me back, they could no longer get comedians who were of the quality that they were used to. But in the intervening time, I had become of the quality that they were used to, and I could go out into any of those rooms.
Okay.
And I could,
sure.
And I could turn around any audience. I could walk out into, like, I ended up doing Portsmouth Jonglers four weekends in a row, emceeing. And I did gigs for them every single weekend. And that Portsmouth Jonglers gig is the worst gig that has ever been run at that level. And it taught me so much.
That's beautifully specific. I don't disagree.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was an aircraft hangar of a venue with really loud AC, and just everything about it was set up wrong. It was awful. And people who were in there had all been on, there were stag parties who'd all like paid Groupon prices. So they had absolutely no commitment to the night going well at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I spent an entire year just going around and troubleshooting those really shitty Jonglers gigs as they'd stopped paying people, because they were still paying me.
Yeah.
And they seemed to have stopped paying everyone else. And from doing that, suddenly off the back of that, whenever I got called up to do any of the other sort of like gigs that would be able to therefore then be able to allow me to get paid weekend work, suddenly I was able to do that. And I was doing a lot of that. And every gig that I got brought into, they were like, you are a lot better than we remember and a lot better than we expected. And so suddenly I had this like full complement of work in my diary, which I'd never had up until that point. I'd really struggled, because a lot of the time I would turn up and it would be like, and even if I didn't struggle, people had such a bad idea of who I was. I remember doing the Frog and Bucket, which I now close, which is like getting booked in to close the Frog and Bucket was one of my bucket list, pun intended. But and because when I started out, I remember my first gig there doing Beat the Frog and walking off the wrong side of the stage and banging my head and having such a rush of anxiety about being on that stage anyway, because I was up there going, this is where Peter Kay played and this is where Johnny Vegas played and this is one of the gigs where Carolina Hearn used to hang out. And I had I grew up such a comedy nerd and never thought I'd be able to do it. And to be able to go in and do those gigs, my last gig before the pandemic shut everything down was the Late Show at the Comedy Store on the Saturday night. And I was like, if that's got to be my last ever gig, then that is a great last ever gig to do. You know, you reach the top.
Yeah. Absolutely. Just on that, why did the spectre of if that's the last gig I ever do, is that just bigging up how meaningful that was? Or is the spectre of that maybe having been the last gig you'll do, is that floating around?
I think it's both. I think when I was driving home that night, I was like, huh, if that is the last gig I ever do. Because I was driving home and I haven't left the house since. That was the 16th of March, 2020.
Haven't left the house?
Well, I've left the house three times. Once to get my teeth fixed because I accidentally bit into a fork, which is the perfect thing you want to do during the middle of lockdown and then have a dentist go, don't bite into a fork. I was like, oh yeah, really? I did it on purpose, did I? Because this was my idea of a good day out. Like, check yourself. And the other two times, once I had to go to the pharmacy and once I had to take my partner to the hospital for an appointment, because we're both like immunocompromised. So we're living in danger. So we've not left the house since March. We've been shielding since March.
Oh, my God.
And, but yeah, do you know, now that, I mean, about a month in to not leaving the house, I was like, yeah, that probably is going to be the last. I'm not going to go back and do stand up when I can do. I'll concentrate. Because at the time, I've been pushing myself too hard and doing too many gigs and being on the road too much for about 3 or 4 years. And just really starting to feel it now that I'm in my 40s and starting to notice that, you know, I don't have anywhere near the energy I used to have. I can't finish a gig in Exeter at 11 and then drive up to the middle of Lancashire and get in at 4 o'clock in the morning and then still have a following day that works.
Sure.
You know, it takes me 2 or 3 days to recover from that. And the amount of days that I could commit to going out and gigging and being on the road was getting smaller and smaller. And the times that I was away doing weekend gigs, when I wasn't on stage, I was in the hotel room because otherwise I'd end up just wearing myself out too much and then losing other time. So I'd already committed in 2020 to spend less time on the road and spend more time writing and writing for TV and things. And so I've done that. The world took care of that for me. And I think by about June or July, I was like, do you know what? I don't think I'm ever going to go back and do stand-up again. I've loved it, and it has been the best experience of my life. And, you know, in those moments when you go, I've never achieved anything. And then my partner would go, what are you talking about? You've never achieved anything. You're a regular at the Comedy Store. You headlined the Frog and Bucket. Both of those are things you wanted to do. You've played Glastonbury. You were in Doctor Who. You were a main character in a Russell T Davies series. You've done all of these things. You've done everything that you ever wanted. All of the things that you ever set out to do all of your lifelong ambitions you've achieved. What are you talking about? You've never achieved anything. And I was like, oh, yeah, of course.
It gets harder, doesn't it? Or does it? Does it get harder to convince yourself that you're the piece of shit you worried you might be?
Yeah.
My words, not yours. Does it get harder to convince yourself, oneself, when the evidence racks up? Or does one tend to discount the evidence?
You tend to discount the evidence because you forget about it. Because, like, you have these goals, and then once you've achieved them, then they're just stuff that you've done.
I realized something like that some time ago, maybe last year. I was thinking about what it must be like to be a movie icon, not just a star, but an icon, someone who's done everything, you know, Malkovich or someone like that, someone who's like done just countless interesting, brilliant, fun projects.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, but the thing is, those projects, as soon as you complete them, they're in the past.
Yeah.
And I think it was because I read an interview with someone, they were talking about the fact they never watched their movies back.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh yeah, you don't sit around, you're not a film fan in the same way that film fans are film fans. You have the exciting adventure of being in, for some reason I'm going to say, in the Line of Fire.
Yeah.
Just because
it's a great
really
film.
I can really see Malkovich testing his plastic gun on that passerby. You know, fantastic scene. But once you've done that, you've had the experience of doing your half of it, which isn't, or your part of it, which isn't by any means the same as being an assassin. It's doing a load of things and living in a caravan for a bit. But then it's over and it's simply a part of your past, and then it's on to the next challenge. And so I was thinking about that in terms of, like, what is there concrete to which we can really hang on and say, I did that.
I think that's why awards become a thing.
because
then it's something concrete to go, you see, everybody did like me. I did reach the top. I did reach the top of what it was I was wanting to do. It's like, of all of the things, like, in my head now, when I started off, like, my goal with stand-up was because I got asked to do, I got asked to host a cabaret night type thing. Mm. And I went, oh yeah, I can do that. And so I went and wrote like an hour and a half, 2 hours of stand-up for that. Because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. And I went and did it, and only one joke got a laugh. But the one that got a laugh gave me such a rush and made me go, huh, I could actually do this. I could be a stand-up comedian. So my goal then was to go from that to doing my first gig at a proper comedy club to then getting a gig at the weekend. Like, how I saw my career panning out at that point would be, okay, I can do this. Right, find a comedy club where I can go and phone them up and book and get booked in to do a gig, which I will do. And I will come off stage and someone will say, would you like to do the Comedy Store in London? And I'll go, yes, please. And I'll go and do the Comedy Store in London and I'll come off stage and somebody with a big cigar will come up to me and go, I don't know what it is, kid, but you've got it. They want you on.
And they'll hand you the Rich and Famous contract.
Yeah, they'll hand me the Rich and Famous contract and I'll have my own TV show on Channel 4 the following week. And in spite of the fact that that breaks the rules, the following year I would go up to the Edinburgh Fringe and perform a sellout run that would then mean that I'd have to get moved to a bigger venue at the beginning of week two and would end it by winning the best newcomer. And then everybody who'd been horrible to me throughout my time when I was growing up, all of the bullies would go, oh, actually, no, you were right. Can we be friends again? And I'd say no. whilst I headed off to Hollywood to become like as big as Richard Pryor. That was my career goal. Obviously that's changed, but like of all of the things I've ever done, I think still the thing that I like, going back to the Fringe, getting nominated for one of the big prizes, that's like the only thing out of all of those things that I didn't do that I would have loved to have done, which also I still don't think is I think I'm fortunately not famous enough is my favorite phrase, because I did the chase and I did the regular chase rather than the celebrity chase, because when I did the audition at the end of it they said you were really really good but you might be too famous to go on the on the regular chase, we might have to put you on the celebrity chase. And I went, oh,
what stools to fall between.
I know. And I was like, oh great, oh no. And then 2 days later they phoned me up and they went, it's good news, you're not famous enough, you can be on the regular chase. So so I did that, but yeah, just thinking about that, and it's like of all of the things, yeah, so I still think I'm not quite famous enough to be excluded from potentially being nominated for the main prize at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah.
And I still sort of, like, I think that is, like, the only stand-up career goal that I still have.
Yes.
Really. So anything that's not aiming towards that kind of feels like treading water.
With regard to that story that you said, which I think will resonate with a lot of people, you know, the bullies will ask if they can be my friends now and I'll say no. It's very Rorschach, you know.
Yeah.
I think that will resonate with a lot of people. But in terms of, like, the kind of, in, like, there's that journey mapped out and you as a person on that journey, you display, as comics do, an amount of vulnerability. And I want to talk to you about what vulnerability you display, because I think it's a part of why you attract the fan base that you attract. And we talked about them, and you know, maybe you're a hero to the people who once upon a time you didn't want to be a hero to them because you were one of them. Like that herodom didn't mean as much to you.
Yeah.
Do you think that, let's start there. Do you think that your vulnerability, your openness about your various conditions, say, or your openness about your feelings, is part of what's attractive?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think when I first wrote my first Edinburgh show, Beth Becomes Her, which detailed my coming out as trans to my family and transition and everything that I went through, it was the summer before I did that. I just set up a new gig and I'd started, there was someone who I was chatting with, someone who helped me to set the gig up, who we were clearly flirting with each other. We were clearly, there was something there. There was a spark there. And we'd gone off and we'd sat in a coffee shop and we were talking about setting up this gig. But there was definite subtext there. And we just started talking about our lives. And I ended up telling her the story because it just sort of came up. Sorry, my cat has jumped on my lap. So if you can hear her purring, that's what that is. We ended up telling a story about a failed suicide attempt, which obviously, you know, doesn't sound like a great date story.
Yeah.
But it kind of, it was just talking about, and we were talking about the various different things that we'd been through and but in a fun way. And this kind of came up and it was a funny story, which is one of the stories from the start of me doing Beth Becomes Her. And it's a true story, which has since then been done as a fake gag on the second Anchorman movie. and because it was the story about how I'd reached rock bottom and didn't think that if I came out as trans that I thought I'd lose my family and I thought I'd lose my friends and I couldn't face anything else and I felt like I'd become such a massive failure that I went to hang myself and I tied my dressing gown cord around the light fitting and stepped off a chair and then dragged the entire ceiling down. And And that was kind of, and I, the way that I told it, it was, because you know sometimes when you tell the stories that are really emotional, really personal, that you can do it in a way with flourish and with the way that you're telling them that they become hilarious and they become funny. And that's what had happened in this. And afterwards, I was chatting with two of my friends. Comedian Michael J. Dolan was one of them, and told them this story and told them the story about, you know, doing that and thinking, you know, as I hung there, I should probably have done this before I put on 6 stone through comfort eating, but just before I dragged this ceiling light down. And he went, do you tell that story on stage? And I went, oh God, no, no. And he went, you should do, because, you know, that's where the art lives. And that has been sort of like my guiding principle since then, is the find the story that you would never normally even tell your best friend. The thing that you're embarrassed about, the thing that you think that people will judge you harshly for.
Yeah.
And tell that story to a group of strangers, because that is where art is. Because art, that's absolutely where the art of what you're saying lies. That's where your connection will be. Because you can go out and you can tell one-liner jokes all day, and I absolutely adore one-liner comedians. I wish I could do what they do, and I can't. And I remember chatting with Gary Delaney and going, I wish I could come up with jokes like yours. He said, I wish I could do stories, but I can't. I love those guys and I love what they do, which always makes it sound like I'm just being an arsehole. But, you know, you come away from watching them and you don't get any more takeaway than you brought with you. It's that thing of, like, watching them do that. It is art, and it's in a very different way. But the sort of stuff that I feel like I've managed to make a connection with people, the sort of connection that lasts, the sort of connection that makes people go, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
Is in sharing something that you think you're the only person who says.
And does that cost you something? Because I've heard that idea expressed in different ways before. It's come up on the podcast before, the idea that you think of something that you would never tell anyone. And of course, anyone listening to this is going to think of something that they would never tell anyone. And then the vast majority of people are going to think, oh, Christ, not that. Like, do you know what I mean? That's the thing, to be able to really kind of get into the guts of the thing you would never say. The reason you would never say it is because it makes you terrifically vulnerable that people might say, oh, God, what, really? You really think like that? Or even if it goes on to become your best bit, the first time or one time you say it, it gets nothing and they stare at you aghast.
Yeah.
What did it cost you as someone who, certainly on, you know, if this episode is people's first experience of you, you sound like you would say anything about yourself.
Yeah, I do. And I have shared so many things, and it has cost me so much. It's cost an awful lot. Just in terms of my mental health as well, as on top of everything else, it has. I've paid a price for it. Right, it's a complicated thing to get into, and I'm happy to get into it here, and I'm you know, proud that I can do. Right. Where to begin? I ended up a couple of weeks ago having to tell my mum to stop telling me to go out of the house because it'll do me good, in her words. Go out for a walk, it'll do you good. And for the 18th time since lockdown began, I had to explain to her what agoraphobia is. And she said, well, why? You used to be someone who was able to go out and put yourself out there, and you say all of these things that you say on stage, and you do all of these things that you do, and you're able to go out and fight all of these fights. Why are you scared of leaving your house and going to the shops, or leaving your house and going out for a walk? And I ended up having to say to her, because I did all of those things. Sometimes the sharing is good, sometimes it's not as great. Sometimes I found myself telling stories because I felt like I needed to tell them, because I felt like I needed to be pure to that principle, to that artistic principle. And instead of providing catharsis, or instead of having experienced these things and moved through them and been in a place where I could talk about them in a healthy way that was healing to me, but also funny to an audience, they just became re-traumatizing. And they put me repeatedly in situations where I felt like I had been too vulnerable, where I felt like I'd shared too much of myself, where I felt like I would, whenever I put myself forward for in any of these things, that it would come back and bite me. I mean, my first two Edinburgh shows, the first one went great. And I got some really good reviews and I got a couple of really terrible reviews. I got one from The List, which I can remember almost word for word. That was, you would assume that, because it was, again, it was a really personal story about my transition, about suicide attempts, about everything that had gone wrong, about how shitty my life had to be before I came out as trans to my family, about how far it had pushed me. And then it ended with me, the story ended on a high note about how I realised that I was good enough and that I was worthy of being loved. And my partner at the time proposed to me during the Fringe that year. And that became, that in the second half of the Fringe, that kind of became the ending of the story. Mm-hmm. That sort of showed that I had managed to get through this thing. And one of the reviews that I got it wasn't even particularly long, and it just said, you would assume that Bethany Black would have had some interesting stories to tell, but she chose not to tell them, instead focusing on all of the positives.
Okay.
And that was like, that knocked my confidence, because that was someone who'd gone and taken something that was deeply personal to me, and something that I, as a kid, constantly, because of the way that I just remember everything and talk about everything, constantly being told that I was boring. That's one of the things that, like, really hurt on that level. But it also stuck with me throughout the thing, that it was like, I'm trying to create my own narrative. I'm trying to tell this thing, and they're saying, ah, well, yeah, we want tragedy. We aren't ready for you to be telling a positive story about this aspect of your life. This is what we want. And the next year I followed it up, and it was supposed to be a show about how some of the most ridiculous decisions I've ever made have been as a result of either being in love or being drunk. And in the April of that year was when I realised that I was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And so between April and August, I essentially wrote a show about realising that. And one of the things that happens when you get clean and sober is that for the first 18 months to 2 years, you're fucking insane. Because you're suddenly not having the things that you've used to cope with all of the horrible shit that's been going on in your head and in your life for all of these years. And suddenly you have to try and come to terms with a lot of that, and you're having all of the emotions that you'd suppressed and haven't dealt with throughout the entirety of the time that you were active in addiction and drug taking and alcoholism. And I did a show, and it wasn't quite ready to go to the Fringe, and I took it to the Fringe, and I think it was like the first Saturday of the run, it was quite a delicate show about realizing that you're an addict. And like, on the first Saturday of the run, Spank had sold out downstairs, and so I ended up with all of their overflow, who just absolutely fucking destroyed the show. Like, just, there were three guys in there who dropped acid, who just like, behaving so badly and just completely broke what the show was supposed to be. And I got loads and loads of really bad reviews that year. And that stopped me from going back to do The Fringe until 2016. So that was like 2009 to 2016. So it was 7 years I didn't do The Fringe because of the experience that I had then. Mm-hmm. And once that had happened, then every single day doing that show, I was performing to between, I think I performed to two people on one night doing that show, and both of them were reviewers. That was a weird one. And every single day going in to do that show at 11 p.m. and it became more like doing a 9-to-5 job than doing a 9-to-5 job ever was, because I was being brutally honest about myself, and I was sharing this information and sharing this show to an audience that wasn't there particularly. It was costing me money I couldn't afford, and the reviewers just seemed to pick on me in the same way that the popular kids that I'd hated at school seemed to pick on me. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And so instead of being cathartic or a show that could then grow and develop over that time, it just became a show that kept re-traumatizing me about these things. So that was a really, really difficult thing to sort of get past. So when I went back in 2016 and did my Fringe show, which that show was about how I'd gone from having the worst couple of years from like 2012, where just like one person after another in my life died. I broke my leg. I got made homeless. I had all sorts of horrible stuff just happening, like day after day after day. It was like everyone else's 2016 to 2020. I had that from, I had that from like 2011 to 2016. And then I had everyone else's 2016 to 2020 to deal with on top of that. So I was already, at least I was prepared for the last 5 years. And so when I went back and did that, I really made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to read any reviews. Partly because Mark Watson had said, like, don't bother reading reviews because if they're good, they don't help. And if they're bad, they don't help. And yeah. I went further than that and just really using the degree that I'd had in cultural studies and film and television, just looked at what the role of a critic was and just went, well, yeah, a critic isn't actually isn't criticizing anything. They're not, when they give you a review, they call it a review and it's supposed to be, all right, this is, we deal with reviews almost as if they're some sort of objective idea of whether or not something is good based on a set of criteria when it isn't. Sure. What reviews are is somebody writing down their reaction to a piece of art.
Yeah.
And if it's a bad review, it's not a bad review. It doesn't mean your work is bad and it's not a bad review of your work. What that is someone writing down that they didn't make the connection and that they didn't understand the work. It's their failing.
Yeah, if they were called the opinions, yeah, that would change. How are the opinions? Oh, I had a good opinion the other day.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's really, yeah. Oh, sure, nice.
Yeah, I think that would make it much better.
I had a house full of good opinions last night. Yeah.
And it's that thing of like, yeah, if reviewers really don't understand the work, like it's more power to them being so confident to be so wrong in public. Oh, because going, oh, yeah, do you know what? I didn't understand that. Oh, well, really? Yeah. One star for me.
Are there other ways, obviously, that you're talking about the cost, the high price you sort of pay there for exposing yourself in that, yeah, way, for talking about the things. Presumably there is also a benefit there that you do attract an audience. It can sometimes be cathartic. It can relate to people. You presumably get the sensation,
oh, yeah,
that you exposing yourself has helped someone else come to terms with, you know, their diagnosis of some neurodiversity or their life experience in some,
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that made me like cry after that first Edinburgh Fringe, I got a message, and it was MySpace, so it shows what the date was, but I got a MySpace message from somebody who'd been to see the show, who had said that they had to get in touch with me. They'd ended up getting the tickets to see my show last minute. And they had no idea what it was. And they sat down and they were about to walk out at the 10-minute mark when they realised that it was the story of me being trans and coming out and coming to terms with that. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. They sat there and they sat through it. And they wanted to thank me so much that they were in tears at the end of it and that they thought it was absolutely wonderful. And to say thank you so much because I had disowned my child when they came out as trans.
Oh, goodness.
And it was watching your show and feeling like and sitting there and forcing myself to confront that made me realise how wrong I'd been. So if I've done literally nothing else in my career, that's enough. That's enough. That is enough for any of the sorry, I'm going to cry and I don't want to because, yeah, it just feels ridiculous. For any of the horrible things that have happened or any of the shitty things or any of the prices that I've paid for any of the things that I've done or any of the things that I've said, on a personal level, the fact that if I can go out, when I go out there and I tell the truth in the way that I do, and when I go and share my experience, my perspective, I only know about that one because that's someone who told me. And I know that other people have got in touch and years later and said, I saw you talk about this and I didn't realise. And from realising that, I have become a better person, or I've gone away and I've done these things. Or like, I didn't realise that I was autistic and it was listening to you talking about it. And now I feel better about that. I didn't realise I had ADHD and it's allowed me to get away from all of the shame that I had in relation to that.
Does that must be incredibly motivating to hear that. What a thing to hear from people that you can affect huge kind of realization, sort of self-actualization sort of stuff, that you can act as a catalyst for that. Is it ever demotivating? Does it ever feel like a burden? Do you ever sort of think,
oh God, yeah.
Oh God, if I've done that for someone, I've got to keep doing it now.
Yeah, it does. It does. Because on the one hand, it is beautiful and it's wonderful and it's great to hear these things. And it's so nice to hear back from that. And, you know, and I have people who have discovered, like, one of the recent things, somebody got in touch with me to say that since they'd spoken to me, they realized that they had ADHD and they'd managed to get a diagnosis and they'd managed to get medication for it. And it's been life changing for them. And it's so, their life is so much better. And I was like, that's fantastic. And then about 2 months later, they said, I just thought I should let you know, from me discovering this, 4 other people have realized this and I've gone off. And I'm like, all right, okay. And it's like, it's the chain reaction. I mean, because I remember one of the most important comedy memories for me, live comedy memories, was Brendan Burns in 2004, maybe 2005, at Glastonbury. The year that he did the Magic Mushrooms, it was Brendan versus Burnsy Part 2. And he arrived at it was the year that, it would have been 2005, because it was the year that mushrooms were made illegal in the UK, magic mushrooms. And the entire tent got high on magic mushrooms because him and Paul Provenza and I think Janie Godley drove them in a minibus and managed to get them past security because they were like, it was like, hang on, we're going to have a look at what's in the van. It's like, no. He's due on stage in 5 minutes. And they were like, all right, okay, yeah, let him through. And I watched him do that show, and he was in the middle of a bad mushroom trip, and afterwards we chatted and sat down and we became really good friends after that. And I remember from watching that and the magic mushrooms that I took on that particular occasion, and now I can't remember whether he said it or whether it was the realization that I came to, that like I've spent so much time trying to figure out what the meaning of life is. And the realization that we're the universe experiencing itself subjectively. And when we die, that goes. So what's important is the interactions that we have and the connections that we make and the ripples that we create on the pond, because they carry on having effects long beyond anything that we will do. And that is truly what eternal life is. You know, the usual sort of thing you realise when you're on magic mushrooms.
You know, the usual.
You know, yeah, absolutely. The usual thing you go, all right, okay, I've realised the meaning of life. Fantastic. And so that's kind of, and that sort of really stuck with me, that, you know, you create these things and often you don't see the ripples that you have, but also in activism work and other stuff that I've done, it is that thing of, you are trying to make the path easier for everyone who has to follow. And that's always been my guiding principle. You make the path easier for people who have to follow, even if you don't get to see it. And I think it's why the price of being what the right calls a social justice warrior, because they're absolutely terrible at giving us names. it sounds fucking cool. Is that you eventually get to be irrelevant. You create the world. You go and create this world. You make the path easier. You create a world that's better for people who have to follow. And your reward for that is that you seem old and out of touch, and that your ideas are no longer relevant. And when that happens, you find yourself in this situation where you can either go, oh, this is great, or you can go, well, this is terrible. No, I was right. I was right all along. They should be listening to me. They shouldn't be going off and doing their own thing.
I don't disagree with that at all. What are you anticipating? And I'm kind of asking you to maybe be imaginative here. what do you anticipate will be the things that when you're in your 60s and 70s, you have to roll your eyes at and then roll up your sleeves and go, yes, I suppose this is fine. what things will you need to not only tolerate but embrace right now might seem...
It's already happening. It's already happening. And I love that it's already happening, because something happened about 3 months ago that, had I not made peace with this idea, not made peace with my aging and the fact that, because I remember like coming out and being on the lesbian scene in the mid 2000s and seeing the older lesbians who had been around on the scene since the 80s and 90s, who'd been lived through, you know, supporting people through the AIDS crisis and going out and donating blood and doing all of those things. And them seeing the people of my generation out having fun and seeing that, and knowing from talking to various people that some of them, there was a bitterness to some people that these young people were out enjoying all of the things that they'd fought for that they never got to have. And that was kind of part of what made me go, yeah, that's it. Cause it's, you know, it's, you're planting a tree that you never get to sit in the shade of. And the thing that really stuck to me, the thing that got to me was about, middle of last year, it must have been. Somebody chastised me online because my language wasn't trans inclusive enough.
Incredible.
And I thanked him. And a bunch of people just went, do you know who you're talking to? Sort of thing. And I went, no, thank you. Thank you for this. Because I've spent so much of my life feeling like so many of these, I'm fighting battles on so many different fronts. And I so often feel like I'm doing it on my own. It's so good to know that there is somebody who's taken it up and that that I will become culturally irrelevant.
Can I ask what the correction was? That's fascinating. And of course that makes sense. And it's, of course that makes sense. Yeah. Would you mind sharing what the correction was?
I can't even, all I remember, I think I'd gone and just used women when I should have used cis women.
Okay, gotcha.
Because I think they'd said something like, you're making out there like trans women aren't women and cis women, you know, you've not made that correction. And I went, thank you so much for pointing that out. It was a throwaway tweet, but thank you. It was that thing of like going, all right, okay, my language wasn't trans inclusive enough. And it absolutely, that was absolutely right.
Fair point. Yeah.
And if I'd have said that 5 years earlier, if I'd have said the exact same thing 5 years earlier, not a single person, even in the trans community, would have picked me up on it. Because things evolve and because culture changes. And I think that that is so much of it that, when you're sort of like under 45, you are part of the culture that is changing the world, and you are part of going, this is the world that I'm an adult in, and I'm going to, from the age of about 18 to 45, you're like, this is the world that I'm going to inhabit, and this is the world that I want to change. And so young people tend to have the cultural power, and then over 45, you tend to have the political power. So we're now reaching this point where, and around about that age, it becomes so difficult for so many people to suddenly realise that all of the ideas that they had when they were teenagers about how they were going to challenge the establishment are now middle of the road, and they're being told by people who are coming coming behind them that they're, you know, your ideas for how you can change, you are the establishment, what are you talking about? And I think that's the thing that a lot of comedians I've noticed, it was a thing that I'd noticed for about 10 years of going to the Edinburgh Fringe and seeing one comic after another sort of hit around about that age and then do a show which was all about what the hell is wrong with kids these days, they don't do anything like the way that we used to. The kids are the ones who are wrong. Or, like, going fully embracing conspiracy theories at that point. That tends to be... It's one or the other.
What? Just as what? As a reaction to the inability to see... Like, I completely see that. I see it happen a lot.
Yeah, it's
and
that thing of they're like...
Like, what's in a reaction to?
I think it's fading cultural relevance. I think it's that realisation that the world... That their worldview is no longer young and hip. They're not the... They're not.
Yeah, it's if they've grown up challenging orthodoxy.
Yeah.
And then they've sort of found that I can't even quite put my finger on it. There is something like you consider the cultural orthodoxy of the comics in the car with you to be the prevailing cultural orthodoxy.
Yeah.
And so you go, well, I'm going to challenge this then. You go,
yeah.
That's not the orthodoxy you're supposed to be challenging. There's still plenty of orthodoxy left to challenge.
Yeah, there's still plenty of it out there. And it's like, it's the whole thing at the moment, like people talking about cancel culture, which I don't think exists, but also by the same token, it's that thing of even if it did, it's a reaction to the rest of the culture not taking things seriously when people are going, this bad thing's happening. Just let people carry on talking. It'll sort itself out. So people go, all right, okay, well, we'll sort it out then. We'll go, right, okay, well, you've said this and we don't think that that's appropriate. And as a result, we're no longer going to buy your products. We go, my God, they're trying to shut down free speech.
I mean, really, it's accountability culture doesn't work it's not pithy enough. Can someone fix that?
Yeah, exactly. So they're going, oh, well, okay then. I think some of it comes down to that sort of experience and seeing that sort of thing happening. But it's so interesting seeing so many of those comedians who turn up at the, so many comedians who get so close to understanding it and then don't. And they go, well, I think this is terrible because I think with political correctness and people being woke, you're going to scare comics off from saying exactly what it is that they really think. And I think that would be terrible for stand-up comedy. And you go, yeah, it would be. And it is. And it is when it happens. And every single gay comic that you know, every single black and Asian comic that you know, every single female comic that you know, every single trans comic that you know has found themselves deliberately self-censoring stuff that they would come out with, not just because, you know, it might get them cancelled from people online going, God, you've said something awful, but because it has real-world outcomes of things like getting attacked when you get off stage, like having people come for you and sending you abuse all the time. I've ended up having people... when I had like a public Facebook page with a messaging thing on it, I once had somebody send a photograph of my front door with a threat.
Jesus Christ.
Because of something that I'd said on stage about being trans. Do you know what?
And so that's an inescapable conclusion, isn't it? That people who haven't had to suffer that, largely white men, white cis men, are kind of, they have that like the, I don't know quite what it is. I don't know. I've got to choose my words carefully here.
Because I know that a lot of comics listen to this and I know that a lot of them will be very, very cross with me right now. And it's not, and saying this, it isn't a failure of theirs because it is not something that you can spot unless you're told it. And that's the thing. It's why I don't like, when people talk about things like privilege, and I don't like that, privilege and oppression. I don't like using the term privilege because the second you say that, everyone thinks of Jacob Rees-Mogg whereas what it is it's an advantage. You have an advantage because of this thing, whether you like it or not, because that's a less loaded term. That's a term which doesn't say as much. Well, it's your fault. It's not, you've just got an advantage. You know, you've got, like, some people have a height advantage, some people have a weight advantage, some people have a race advantage, some people have a sexuality advantage, you know? There are all of those things that you've experienced. You go, well, you know, you are advantaged in this way and you're disadvantaged in another way. And the problem is sometimes with these things is that you can't see them. It's like class. You tend to only be able to see class from underneath when you're looking up. It's so much more obvious than it is when you're looking down.
Isn't that like most people in the UK who earn over 50 grand a year don't consider themselves wealthy?
Yeah.
Because they look at the context in which they live and they go, well, I'm not one of those wealthy guys over there.
Yeah. And I think it's also because because economics is one of my autistic special interests.
Correct my facts.
No, it's true. But that guy who was on Question Time who said, I'm not even in the top 10% of earners. I'm not even in the top 50% of earners. And he was on 50 grand a year. £23,000 a year is the median wage in the UK. If you're in the top 1%, you earn more than £106,000. If the entire total of your assets accounts to more than £35,000, then you are in the top 50% of rich people in the UK. These are the base stats of that. And the thing is that you tend to be the median within your group. So people always think that they're the median. It's the bandwagon effect. You will hang around with people who are a bit richer than you and a bit poorer than you. And you will want to be as rich as the people who are a bit richer than you. And you will be glad that you're not as poor as the people who are a bit poorer than you. And everyone does that right the way through to both ends of the spectrum. There's literally only Jeff Bezos.
We've only got three helipads, not four Bezos. Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, there are people who hang around with Jeff Bezos who go, oh, yeah, no, I'm in the middle. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I'm only worth, you know, I'm not rich, I'm just comfortable, you know, I'm only
I
worth
think of it,
half
I don't
a
know
billion.
If you've seen, I don't know if you've seen Succession. I think of this all the time, the conversation in season two of Succession where they're going, well, you don't want $5 million, then you're the poorest rich guy.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah, that's it. And I think it's that sort of thing that if you're in the middle of it, you go, oh, well, you only, because again, you're experiencing the world subjectively. You're experiencing everything that's going on around you and you're going, oh, well, this is something that I do. And this is something that, you know, the people I hang around with all think this. So I am against the prevailing orthodoxy. And it's that, I think that's why the idea of so many of the right-wing comics who go, oh, I'm the only right-wing comic, or like that they're, you know, that they feel like they're pushing against something is partly because their view is different. So they end up getting put on a bill in the same tokenistic way often that people from marginalized communities do.
Yes.
You know, I don't see very many other female comics. I've been on a bill with a trans comic on one other occasion. And when I mentioned that to the promoter, I don't think he realized that one or both of us were trans.
Yeah.
You know, you end up in a situation where they go, oh, well, I'll put you on for something a bit different.
Bit of special.
And so I think...
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, and especially when you turn up to a gig where you're the only one of anything that's not related to the norm and two of the other comics have the same name and have to discuss whether or not they're going to do certain bits. And you go, huh, right, okay, so this is the norm, is it? This is the prevailing orthodoxy. And I think that that's, again, another thing which makes people feel like outsiders within a community. Because, like, stand-up, going into a green room with other stand-up comedians for the first time, like, almost every comedian I've ever spoken to, it just felt like coming home. And there are things that you can say and there are things that you can talk about when you're chatting with other comics where you've got shared experiences and you go, yeah, we're all the same, and you can put aside so many of the differences that you have. But then when you get out on stage, you see what people want to talk about and the things that people do talk about and find funny. And it's when you're seeing that, that's where you see the differences in you. And that's where you see those things. And so one of the things that I realized that made me realize that I wanted to get off the circuit in terms of stand up and just do my own touring shows more so. Was that in spite of doing all of these gigs all the time and being around people all the time as part of circuit shows where you've got three comics and an MC, I was still feeling lonely and isolated because I was very rarely on with any other women, very rarely on with any other gay comics, very rarely on with any other trans comics. And so the gigs that I did where I did have those guys, where I was with those guys, the camaraderie that you feel as part of being in a green room was amplified by going, oh, this is what it must feel like for those guys. This is what it must be like for those guys at those gigs, because they can talk about stuff and then afterwards they can go and text each other and go, oh, do you want to go and hang out? And you go, yeah, okay. And you do all of those things that I just kind of still feel like an outsider of even when I'm in green rooms a lot of the time. Yeah, that was not something that I'd intended to reveal, but it's absolutely true and I'm happy to.
So to wrap up, let's get back to Twitch, because this sort of brings us neatly back to what you expect now from the future of your comedy career, perhaps not quite what you expected before. We talked about vulnerability, we talked about your following, and Twitch gives you a following and loves them some vulnerability. So talk to me about the difference between your comedy shows and your Twitch output, because I think a lot of people have been pivoting in the last year.
Yeah.
And I think you're someone that's really kind of got into that. So talk to me about your experience.
Yeah, I have. Like, well, because after I'd done the Mark Watson show, I'd got, it was at that point I went, oh, this Twitch is a thing that people are on and I'm watching. Oh, this sounds like quite a good idea. And I knew a couple of my friends did it. I knew that Ashley Story did it and I knew that Roscoe McClellan did it.
Yeah.
And I just one night, on Twitter just went, would anybody be interested if I was to go and do a Twitch stream where I just went and played my old favorite Pokemon games for an evening, would anybody be interested in watching? And loads of people just went, that sounds amazing. So I went, huh, okay. And then went to do that, did one show of me playing Pokemon and went, huh, yeah, I can think of a much better way to use this medium. And then immediately just went and switched over from that into essentially what I do now, which is every day at 2 o'clock I do a show called A Brew and a Chat,
yep,
where I just react to whatever's going on in the chat. I have a little chat box that comes up because just recognizing that it's a new medium that's somewhere between radio and television, but also it's like live performance, but on TV, but where the audience can actually properly interact with it. So it goes, it's this whole new medium that I think had been used for such a long time for just angry 14-year-old boys playing Call of Duty that no one has really gone, huh, what else can we do with it? And just looking through the things that people are creating on there, it's just some fantastically creative stuff. Yeah. I think even more so than things like YouTube. There's someone who I follow called Squilky who comments on, but joins in the chat of mine, who does like 6-hour long streams of them doing pottery live. I've seen people doing all sorts of stuff. One of the stranger ones I saw was a guy sat there silently reading a book for 6 hours.
because it has... One of the most exciting things about Twitch for me is that it hasn't finished evolving yet. It may never finish evolving. So the idea of looking at it and going, oh, it's like interactive YouTube. Well, it can be, but it needn't be. People, I couldn't believe it the first time someone told me, oh, what I do is I put it on in the background. I use it like the radio.
Yeah.
Oh, right. You could do that with it. You know what I mean? Like I haven't got my head around the pretty infinite sounding possibilities.
Yeah. One of my friends got in touch and went, I really love your show. And I was like, oh God, I didn't realize you were watching my show. And they went, oh no, I just put it on. It's like choosing who I get to have as my work colleague to talk to for the day.
Yes.
That you can sit there and just enjoy what it is that you're doing and just talk about things or play games. And it's just about being, it's about engaging with people is what it is. And it's making that connection. And this is the thing that I really love about it, is that it allows me to go through whatever I'm thinking about on that day, whatever's in the news, whatever it is that has particularly caught my attention. And I can just talk about that for an hour, and I'm finding an audience for it, and my audience is getting bigger and bigger, and I'm making money from it. I'm able to make money from it, and recognizing that I will probably be able to make about the same amount from Twitch as I did from stand-up within a year.
Incredible.
Recognizing
with no overheads, right?
Yeah, with no overheads, other than the fact that I've gone and, I mean, I bought the Blue Yeti mic that I have for other
sure.
things,
but
and
no,
I got a
no,
ring light.
Far less in the way of running costs.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, all of those things are gone, and you know, and like so many of the things that I've needed for it, I went and put a wish list up on Twitch, and people who watch it went, "Oh, do you know what? Yeah, I'll go bung a fiver in to get you a new ring light or a proper tripod for your desktop so that you can get your camera at the right angle." Or
we're all street performers now, baby.
Yeah, absolutely, it's great. And it's that thing of going, yeah, I can be a street performer with agoraphobia. It's fucking wonderful.
Yes, there we go. That's nailed it. Very good.
That feels like what it is, and it's been so good and so freeing, and it feels like such a connection to other people, because every single day I'm making that, and it feels like socializing. In a way, performance and socializing, and also on like certain days when things come up in the news that I have like a keen interest on already, that I've been able to do like one-off half-hour shows that I've essentially been like just a half-hour comedy lecture on a single issue, you know, basically like John Oliver does, only nowhere near as good, obviously, but all of those caveats, not even comparing myself to the person who I managed to annoy so much all those years ago at Excess Malarkey by being dead. and asking him questions like 6 months before he went off to become famous. So like last week or whenever it is that you're listening to this, remember all the way back in January of 2021 when the GameStop stocks became a big news story, and because of my keen interest in economics and stuff around this, and my love of the movie Trading Places, I did like a half-hour one-off special show just explaining how the stock market works, what short selling is, why these guys have done what they've done, the good points and the bad points from it, and managed to do that as a single. It was a 45-minute comedy show that I'd basically written on the day. And was then able to perform.
This sounds like to an agoraphobic, to someone who is excited about ideas, is sort of has an incredible access memory that we, you know, maybe less good than you did when you were six, perhaps, but you know, it's still impressive. Yeah. It sounds like it's a medium tailor made for you.
It is,
and particularly in regard to the interactivity and the talk to the following. That, I mean, I've had my own experiences of creating cult communities on Twitch, and the question I have is, do you apprehend any downsides to it? What are the disadvantages, if any? What can you imagine, given that it is constantly evolving and you're pretty new to it, sort of less than 6 months at the moment?
Yeah.
What do you anticipate? Do you anticipate anything that you've got to sort of steer more carefully?
Yeah, it seems to have the same drawbacks as doing stand-up in terms of the amount that I give to it. The amount of myself that I give over to it, because sometimes when I'm having a bad day, when I'm struggling with my mental health, when I've done a show I can come away from it and going, why am I doing this? Why am I doing I'm making the exact same mistakes. I'm giving too much of myself. I don't want to share who I am all of the time. I just want to be on my own. I've got people who think that I'm ridiculous, who are watching this, who I don't want to be watching this because they're not the people that I want to be attracting because I've got my nice fans that I really like and they're not like them. And they're all, I can't escape that. And people are just always going to be mean and there's always going to be trolls everywhere. And I might as well just not do anything and hide away. You know, all of that horrible negative self-talk that your brain does. And on days, there are certain days when I can feel like that. I think one of the things that I've managed to do to really help sort of get away from that is I've got a really great team of mods in my chat who manage to be on top of anything that's coming through. They manage to get rid of anyone being horrible or, you know. I think that's, for me, that sort of seems to be the downside at the moment. I mean, obviously, there's all of those things that you can't predict, like, will it still be successful in 6 months' time? Will this continue to build? I mean, the way that things are going, I can look at the trends of what's happened since November when I started. And just looking at my viewing figures and my following numbers and my subscription numbers going up and up and up and going, right, okay, obviously it'll hit peaks and troughs and it'll steady off, much like it has done with any other form of social media. Is this a sustainable, is this a viable thing to be doing to continue with? You know, or is it just going to be one of these short-term things that I get, you know, I reach a certain plateau and it works well for a long time, but then other things that I have to do will provide me with more money, more security, more other things, so I won't have as much time to do these things? I don't know. Those are the potential drawbacks that I can see with it. Currently, I'm really, really enjoying doing it. And I'm seeing this as a way of going, and because I can see everywhere across the world, the people who like what I do, and I can see which countries they're in, and I can see what things it is that's engaging them, and I can go, right, okay, well, I can do more of this and this and this and this, so that when we are all vaccinated and can get back out into the wild, and I can go and do live performance again, I can travel all over the world and have enough people in these different places to come and see me do an hour-long show that I've spent 6 months writing and preparing.
Final question. Yeah. On Twitch, in terms of your status on Twitch, your following, your output, how does that fit into the idea of trying to impress the people at school who don't exist anymore?
It feels like I've evolved beyond that now. It's one of the only mediums where I feel like I can genuinely talk about the things that I always wanted to talk about in stand-up, the things where I was like, that's where the art lives, the stuff, the experiences that I want to talk about and share, where because I was performing on Friday and Saturday nights in front of groups of people where I felt, oh no, I can't really talk about this. On Twitch, I'm like, I don't even have to consider those people anymore. They're not even part of my mental process anymore, because I'm not doing anything for them anymore. This is entirely for me and other people like it. And I think that is how it feels like I've got to the purest form of what I was trying to achieve with stand-up in the first place.
What a place to end it. Thank you, Bethany Black.
Thank you.
So that was Bethany. I mean, what a great episode. What a great episode. The price of becoming a social justice warrior is that you eventually become irrelevant. That's great. The reward is that you become irrelevant. I love that. So find Bethany, Bethany Black with two Fs and an IE at the end, Bethany Black on Twitch, twitch.tv/Bethany Black and at Bethany Black on Twitter, and enjoy those things. And thank you to her for coming along. Thank you to Nathan for producing the show. Thank you to Jake Crossland for the logging. Thank you to Rob Smouton for the wonderful music. Your podcast consultant was Peter Dobbing, and I remain steadfastly Stuart Goldsmith. Thanks to those of you who continue to get in touch, checking on me to see if I'm all right. I'm absolutely all right. Hey, here's who you should look at. Here are some people you should follow on Twitter. Ashlyn Draws. I'm assuming it's Ashlyn. I've only ever seen it written down. A-I-S-L-I-N-N. Ashlyn Draws. As in draws things. D-R-A-W-S, you know, draws. Ashlyn Draws. Have a look at that, because Ashlyn has been doing incredible work, doing a sort of comedy lockdown heroes pack of playing cards. And if you look at ComCom Pod, you will see that the rather attractive picture of me as the someone of hearts, what am I, the sixth? I wanted the five, and bloody Stevie Martin got there first. But Ashlyn is phenomenally talented and is also accepting commissions. So check those out. They're really, really good. Anything else? I feel like there's other things to say, but there's never enough time, is there? Let's face it. Thank you for listening. If you are a corporate person and you would like to book me for either an incredible half hour of interactive stand-up comedy via Zoom for your business, which I can honestly, hand on heart, look you in the ear and say is great, and I've done a few of them, and it's so much easier for me to pitch than my own stand-up, because this is just quantifiably brilliant. If you want to get in touch about those, or indeed the virtual office party, then you can get information at virtualofficeparty.co.uk. And by the time you hear this, with a bit of luck, the all-new stuartgoldsmith.co.uk site will be up and running. Hey, here's a thing. If you know another guy called Stuart Goldsmith who owns stuartgoldsmith.com and offered to sell it to me 5 years ago, and has since, that his email address now bounces and I can't track him down, tell him to get in touch. I'd be interested in restarting that chat. Who wouldn't want the .com when it's just sat there not being used? But I can't find him anywhere. It's great. Shall we do a manhunt? Shall we do? Absolutely. I'm going to absolutely walk back the phrase manhunt. But if you know personally the Stuart Goldsmith, who is the author of The Midas Touch, which is sort of some kind of personal wealth management, some sort of thing like that, then by all means, nudge him to get in touch with the other Stuart Goldsmith, or maybe one of the other Stuart Goldsmiths, if lots of us have been in touch with him, a bit like the movie Her. So I'd be interested in me. So I'm not saying let's not do a manhunt. What I'm saying is, isn't it fun to try and track down a different person with your name? Hey, there might be a show in this. Quickly rewinds to 1997. Okay, gang, thank you for listening. I could post-amble at you. I'll be honest, it's probably not a good time for me to post-amble. I'll explain why in the post-amble. Bye for now. So look, it's probably not a great time for me to post-amble at the moment, just because I'm recording this on a Monday after having had a sort of reflective practice meeting with a friend of mine who is kind of like a business mentor. Hello to you. And then therapy. Now here am I recording a podcast. So it's been an absolute whirlwind of a day, but a very positive one. Thanks to those of you who've been in touch checking that I'm all right. I am absolutely all right. I got a lovely, I won't say who, but a lovely comedian texted me and I must get back to them. I'm doing really well. I think at the end of the Jordan Brooks one, I revealed that I'd been wobbling a bit, and it is a wobbly time for us all, but I'm feeling pretty positive. And I tell you what, the school's apparently going to go back in 2 weeks, and right now the sun is shining. So let's not focus on what it's cost us. Let's focus on what we're costing it. Does that make sense? No, it absolutely doesn't. Oh, that reminds me, though. Rhys James, I think, a brilliant comic, Rhys James, has been doing some very funny kind of demotivational posters. So have a look for them. You can probably follow him on Twitter. Let's look while you're there. I think in the post-amble I'm allowed to just... It's Rhys Jamesy, isn't it? There we go. At Rhys, R-H-Y-S, Jamesy. So James with a Y on the end. And his biog says he's a comedian and ghost. Why the fuck hasn't he done the podcast? He should get on it right now. Anti-inspirational posters he's doing. So check those out to see one of them now, which I'm not going to repeat. But go to @RhysJamesy on Twitter and find out about them. And God, even his banner's funny. Jesus, he's funny. Right, I'm going to ring him up now and get him on. Thank you. That's everything. I'm obviously a bit manic. It's been a hell of a day, but great episode. Cracker in the can with Olga Koch. Oh, my word. What a great episode. We get into the programming language of computers and the similarity, the parallels with writing jokes. She describes a joke, which she then describes as recursive, and I lose my mind. It's a fantastic episode. It's coming your way soon. And also, three really fun people are coming up. Three really good, fun, funny people are coming up. But, you know, I never like to say their names until I've got them locked in the can. So for now, they will need to remain mystery guests. Bye for now. Thank you. Do check out Bethany Black on Twitter and Twitch. And thank you for listening and all of that stuff. Yeah, it's absolutely fine. I'm absolutely fine. Oh, God. Do you ever... I'm sure I saw a tweet along these lines. I think every comedian reckons... I think this, and this tweet, someone made the point in a tweet, and I can't even credit them because I don't remember. It's weeks and weeks ago. But it really made me laugh. I'm just disclaiming the fact this isn't really an original thought. This is someone else's brilliant tweet, which I will now butcher. Just the concept being that every comedian thinks they're amazing in therapy. Honestly, I think she should be paying me. Oh, yeah, a bit much. Too much. Too much. Okay, bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.